saying that teachers should always act with great caution and that principals must ensure that schools are a place of growth and not a place where one looks for media exposure. Max Civili, Rome.
Another black day for the residents of the west of Kabul. Today morning, a bomb hit the Kaj Educational Center in Dasht-e Barchi area in Sheikh Hazara neighborhoods. Students were sitting a practice university exam when the explosion went off. The victims of the incident were taken to the hospital. Their relatives report a high number of casualties.
My sister and my cousin were brought here to the emergency hospital. They are now in critical health conditions. They were at the educational center for their exams. As I witnessed, the victims were all innocent people. I saw nearly 60 to 70 people dead and wounded in one individual hospital.
Terrified Muhammad Issa has brought his wounded niece to this hospital. He calls on the Taliban and the global community to do something to help get rid of such attacks.
I saw a lot of people killed or injured. It was very shocking. I visited the educational center. Scores of bodies were laid on the floor. People are terrified. I don't know why there is no end to our suffering. They attack us everywhere. Till when? I call on the global community to do something for the situation of Afghan people, especially Hazaras.
Here, Taliban security officials are visiting the site of the explosion. They say they will take all necessary steps for tightening security for all.
Islamic Emirate is watchful for the security of the people, especially in western Kabul. I promise that everything will come under our control and such incidents won't happen in the future. Such attacks on innocent students are carried out by the enemies of Islam and the people of Afghanistan.
Mosques and educational centers in Sheikh Hazara neighborhoods in Kabul have been the target of terrorist attacks for years. The Daesh terrorist group have claimed responsibility for most of such attacks. People here in western Kabul say the seemingly endless violence has exhausted them. They want peace, security, and justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
For many years, the people of Donbas have been waiting for this historic day, which was preceded by bloody war in the east of Ukraine that led to the intervention of the Russian army to save the Lugansk and Donetsk people from genocide. Despite Western pressure, the Russian president did not hesitate to accept the request of four regions of eastern Ukraine to join the federation through a referendum described as successful by authorities in those regions. Central Election Committee representatives reported that those who took part in the votes decided overwhelmingly in favor of the accession to Russia.
The unbroken people of Donbass, Zaporizhia and Kherson said the word. I want the authorities in Kyiv and their real masters in the West to hear me, and I want everyone to remember this. People living in DPR, LPR, Kherson and Zaporizhia have become our citizens forever.
In a ceremony attended by the heads of Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson and Zaporozhye regions, Vladimir Putin signed a decree for the formal accession of the former Ukrainian territories controlled by the Russian army over the past months. As a result, the four regions became part of the Russian Federation, which is now obliged to protect them from any aggression under the constitution and the Russian military doctrine.
Today we're fighting for a just and free path. First of all, for ourselves, for Russia, for diktat, despotism to remain forever in the past. I am convinced that countries and peoples understand that a policy based on exclusivity of anyone, on the suppression of other cultures and peoples, is inherently criminal, that we must turn this shameful page. The collapse of Western hegemony that has begun is irreversible. And I repeat again, it will not be the same as before.
Our country is taking back its historical lands that our grandfathers defended. I am inspired that I caught and I am a participant of this moment. These territories and our people were artificially divided.
The West, led by the United States, has been supplying all kinds of weapons to Ukraine, sending large numbers of mercenaries to the country, and imposing huge economic sanctions against Russia. But it has failed to stop Moscow's special military operation in Ukraine. And for the Donbas, Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, which have been fighting for their right to become part of Russia, the accession means, first of all, security and sustainable economic development for them.
The right and decision of the four regions to join Russia is undoubtedly a historical moment. Moscow says strikes by Ukraine on those territories joining Russia today will be seen as an act of aggression against the state. It has vowed to protect the territories at all cost after their accession to Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A recent report by the Pentagon says 12 civilians were killed in drone strikes during 2021 in Afghanistan. Two were killed in separate airstrikes in Herat and Kandahar, and 10 members of a family in a drone operation in Kabul just before the U.S. withdrawal. Although General McKenzie admitted that the incident was a mistake, but none of the U.S. military forces went on trial for this attack. The report also compares the number of casualties in 2021 and 2020. It shows there is a decrease, but those aren't the only years the U.S. was present in Afghanistan. The United States came to Afghanistan in 2001 and left the country in 2021. Armed drones were used by the U.S. military from the beginning. Still, there is no mention of the overall number of casualties in the report.
In recent years, the U.S. and the Taliban were negotiating and agreed that the U.S. reduces drone attacks, and that is why we witnessed a decrease in casualties during these two wars. This does not mean the Americans value human rights or have reduced errors and miscalculations in their operations. Drawing a comparison between these two years can't simply be a positive point for the Pentagon.
The exact number of casualties during the 20 years of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan is unknown, but the statistics show a 330% increase in the figure since 2017, when the U.S. military relaxed its rules of engagement for airstrikes in Afghanistan. Another source estimates more than 1,000 civilians have lost their lives in air raids, but that only includes the death toll from 2015 to 2020, which accounts for only 5 years of the U.S. presence. The survivors of U.S. attacks never received proper compensation, and no American troops were duly tried for their wrongdoings in Afghanistan. The reason, as stated most of the time, was that the investigations never found any violation of the law. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The moment when, via live link from a neighboring room, the Electoral Committee of Donetsk People's Republic announced to the press their intention to join Russia.
Colleagues, on the question raised for the referendum, do you support Donetsk People's Republic entering the Russian Federation by the rights of its subject is considered to be confirmed? I ask you to sign the protocol. It's a historical signature. I congratulate you.
These are historical days now. We are reuniting with our big motherland, Great Russia. Now we can breathe out, take a break for half a day, and continue creating, building, and repairing. But now we are not going to do it alone. Our brothers, our friends are with us now. I would like to thank every Donbass citizen. You are heroes.
Meanwhile, NATO countries have dismissed the votes as a sham. They say they are illegal under Ukrainian and international law. I put this question to Denis Pushilin moments after the result was made official.
Ukraine and NATO countries call this referendum illegitimate, and Russia is the only country so far to say that this referendum is legitimate. What do you have to say to those critics?
You know, once there was a time when Western countries didn't recognize the USSR. Our way is defined. The Western point of view was expected. Of course, we'll take into account their opinion, but we'll now act following the interests of our mother Russia.
Regardless of whether the West sees these referendums as legitimate or not, in the coming days, Russia will announce that these regions are now part of the Russian Federation, ushering in a new stage in the Russia-Ukraine war. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The World Bank, in its latest report on Afghanistan, has said that global food and energy prices continue to put pressure on basic household prices in the crisis-stricken country. At the same time, rising inflation and slow recovery in nominal wages have decreased the people's ability to buy basic goods.
Today, we witness people have lesser purchasing power. Previously, a middle-class household used to pay nearly $200 to buy multiple goods, but today they only ask for very basic necessities like oil and flour. You know, the prices are increasing. In addition, the banking crisis and sanctions have affected the prices and business in the market.
The World Bank report has confirmed that since June 2022, Afghanistan's currency has depreciated slightly against the U.S. dollar, while the prices of basic food and fuel items continue the upward trend. Abdullah Rizayi, who has been working as a shoemaker for almost half of his life, says he had never experienced such economic conditions before.
In the past years, I used to make sufficient income from this job. Currently, I'm not only receiving fewer customers, but the money that I earn has lost its value. I used to make 300 Afghanis per day, but nowadays I hardly can make 50, which is the price of 5 loaves of bread. Sometimes I feel ashamed when I look at my children.
In the meantime, widespread joblessness is leaving many Afghan families without a solution to make ends meet.
We have had a job once or twice a week in the spring and summer. I wonder why we should do it in the winter when there is no job to do. People are struggling with hunger and difficulties. Some have their own houses, but they should pay for the house rent too. This year, I fell short of paying the bills, and now I am in debt.
This comes as the World Food Program has warned that Afghanistan is facing its most serious risk of famine in 20 years. The UN body has asked for $1.1 billion life-saving assistance for 18 million people across Afghanistan. The ripple effects of the US sanctions and freezing of billions of dollars in Afghans' assets are pushing up inflation in Afghanistan. People here are calling for the release of assets and more international funding to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Polls show that a divided Congress appears all but assured 6 weeks before the federal legislative vote in the United States, which would also ensure continued political division and stagnation. The Democrat-led inquiry over protests which alleged election fraud in 2020 continue to plod on, but polls show they have had essentially no effect on changing voters' opinions. While longtime Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi looks certain to be forced out of power in November, the top level of Republican leadership looks likely to add more so-called Trumpists, reflecting the enduring influence of ex-President Donald Trump. The biggest unofficial political party in the United States is actually the self-declared independent voter. Polls indicate that a huge swing of 12% has taken place within this king-making group. In 2020, post-election polls found that they favored Democrats by 7%, but independents are now tilting towards Republicans by 5%.
Not happy with the way things are, obviously. We're all worried about inflation and it's impacting our, you know, wallets. I wish there were more parties besides Republicans and Democrats, because it's just, you know, party interests, and people like you and me are just left behind. We have to live our lives, and politicians aren't really thinking about us.
Pollsters say the Democratic Party seems certain to lose control of the lower house of parliament, if not both houses. As the election nears, many expect the ongoing inflation and economic growth disasters caused by blowback from Western sanctions on Russia to play a larger and larger role in voters' decisions. A recent survey by Forbes found that 30% of Americans are drawing from their savings more than usual, which is the highest percentage in the survey's history. Another analysis found that the average American has lost over $4,000 in income since Joe Biden took office due to the increases in the inflation and interest rates. The midterms are on track to be the most expensive vote ever, reaching $10 billion by Election Day. Many say that's a reminder of the enormous role played in American democracy by money and advertising. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
the crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production, and oil fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government, which relies on debt, is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Saleh Hafiz forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Saleh, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
A former member of parliament tells Press TV that the government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In the limelight.
Mismanagement and drought conditions have affected roughly half of the landmass of the 48 contiguous U.S. states. What experts are asking these days is whether the U.S. could survive the mega drought that has gripped the country. Although the federal government has resorted to imposing significant cutbacks in water allocations to the 7 states reliant on water from the drought-stricken Colorado River, there are possibilities that these tactics don't work. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. The title of this article is, Can U.S. Agriculture Survive Mega Drought? Stay with us, please. According to the website of Truthout, the federal government's recent announcement that it would impose significant cutbacks in water allocations to the 7 states reliant on water from the drought-stricken Colorado River is the latest sign that climate change is ravaging global water systems. Arizona will lose more than 20% of its water allocation, and Nevada 8%. Northern Mexico, which is also reliant on the Colorado River and has been provided 1.5 million acre-feet of water per year from the river since a water-sharing treaty between the two countries was signed in 1944, is being hit hard as well, with a 7% reduction in its water allocation from the river. And 30 indigenous tribes, which have land in the Colorado Basin and which, as a result of a 1908 Supreme Court decision, have water rights from rivers running through their territories, are also preparing for a more arid future. Some are cutting back their water contributions to state reservoirs. Others, in a letter to the Department of the Interior, have noted that they aren't being adequately consulted on fundamental decisions regarding water usage and distribution in the region. And this is the mismanagement. In the American West, which scientists now believe is experiencing its worst drought in 1,200 years, tens of millions of people have migrated into the region since the federal water compacts around Colorado River water usage were signed a century ago. Even in non-drought years, the growing population routinely overdraws groundwater supplies, reducing stores of water that's accumulated over vast geological time spans. In the course of just four human generations, areas that once were simply desert have been converted into water-intensive global agribusiness hubs and into megacities such as Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. Ever more reliant on the waters from the Colorado River that are carefully stored in and distributed from Lake Mead and Lake Powell. Now, with these two vast reservoirs at only 28% of their capacity, many of those areas have to find ways to collectively reduce their water usage next year by between 2 and 4 million acre feet, or a third of the annual flow of the river in an average year, which is what federal authorities believe is necessary to bring the river back to health. It's a staggering task. Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Utah, located in the upper basin of the river, are also facing large water supply deficits, though not nearly on the scale faced by their southern neighbors. So far, unlike Arizona and Nevada, they haven't faced mandatory cuts imposed by the federal government. California, being an older state, has more senior water rights than its neighbors to the east, and thus it is for now spared from cuts in its Colorado River allocations. That's a saving grace for Southern California, the sprawling cities of which receive roughly one-third of their water from the river. But relief is tempered by the fact that the state is facing its own devastating water shortages as a result of years of drought and declining snowpack in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Reservoirs such as Shasta Lake and Lake Orville are at or under 50% capacity. More than 500,000 acres of California farmland have been left fallow this year as farmers try to navigate shrinking water allotments from California's water supplies. The crisis of land use will only worsen next year, according to analysts. Drought conditions now affect roughly half of the landmass of 48 contiguous U.S. states. As a result, crops across the U.S. are under stress. The U.S. cotton crop this year could fall by 40%, but from Texas westward, the crisis is omnipresent. Farmers in the western states are reporting crop declines in fruits and tree nuts of up to 50%. Almond crops, which are extremely water-intensive, as well as rye, rice and grapes are at risk in California, where up to 800,000 acres of land could lie unused next year. Tomatoes, garlic, and other staples also aren't being planted in many California farms. And as with earlier droughts, livestock are being slaughtered in Texas, Oklahoma, and other drought-stricken states as owners struggle to pay for increasingly scarce feed and find enough water to keep the animals alive and healthy. All of this is pushing the world's food supply chains into crisis mode. We have gotten used to an abundance of industrially produced cheap food over the last 100 years. In other words, we complacently take it for granted that crises will be staggered rather than occurring simultaneously, that the fates will somehow be considerate in metering the food production challenges they send the way. But what if that assumption turns out to be wrong? What if a series of interconnected and accelerating climate crises around the world erupt simultaneously and rapidly take away the slack from the system? What if large areas of American West not only cease to be agriculturally productive, but also no longer have access to enough drinking water to sustain the tens of millions of people who now call the region home? The cuts to the Colorado River water allocations are unlikely to be simply a one-year blip. While this year's heavy monsoon in the Southwest has somewhat alleviated the drought, it will take years of abundant rainy seasons to make up for the deficits in water supply created by 22 years of drought and decades of caliber overdrawing of scarce reservoir water and groundwater supplies. In the meantime, the American West population continues to grow at unsustainable rates. The demands on its agricultural infrastructure keep expanding, and its insatiable thirst for water shows no sign of easing. If there is an exit from ramp to this particular highway, a method to avoid the pileup just ahead, it's unclear where it is or how it can be accessed. Water rights activists have long called for more equitable distribution of water, for more infrastructure to secure drinking water in poor rural communities in particular, and for a move away from the most water-intensive crops and most water-wasteful practices in areas with dwindling groundwater supplies. Now, as the global water and food crisis intensifies, these issues are acquiring critical importance on social justice campaigns, not just in the US, but around the world.
Arabi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Arabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Arabi English Radio.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK Prime Minister has not been in office for more than a month, yet she has sent the UK economy in a tailspin. First, her announcement of a new tax plan, but it was blasted to benefit the rich more than the poor. And it was then reported that the UK markets lost £500 billion since Liz Truss took over. And then the British pound sunk once again against the dollar as the UK dived deeper into a recession. What is going on with the UK's economy? And is it all the fault of the new UK Prime Minister? That is what we'll be asking our guests in this edition of the program. Our guests joining us for this program are journalist and commentator James Tweedy, who joins us from Plymouth. Also joining us is political and economic analyst Shabir Rizvi, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. James Tweedy, I have this semi-technical question to maybe ask you, but I figured I'd just come out with a really, really simple question. What is going on with the UK's economy under Truss?
Thanks for having me. There's a problem with the economy, and it predates this Truss becoming Prime Minister, and that's the problem, as they call it, the cost of living crisis, which in other words is inflation. Inflation is running at about 10% now, and may rise still, and what that's been caused by the rising prices of natural gas and oil, which is driven by the sanctions on Russia over the its military operation in Ukraine. So, Truss bears responsibility for that because she was foreign secretary at the time the time of the operation started, and she was always one of the leading voices for support for Ukraine and sanctions on Russia. And the Conservative Party everyone knew that that's what she stood for when she was running for leadership of the Conservative Party and to become the new Prime Minister. Her main opponent, Rishi Sunak, it was less certain, but there was people who hoped that he would take a more pragmatic view and ease off on the sanctions. But it's all become kind of irrelevant now because somebody, possibly across the Atlantic, has sabotaged the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines that carry gas from Russia to Germany and other places in Northern Europe.
Okay.
So we're very deep in the crisis now, and it's hard to see how we're going to get out.
Sure. And quickly, if you were to give a percentage fault to Truss for the state of the UK economy now, how much of a percentage would you attribute to her?
Okay. I mean, the question is whether the budget, the mini budget on Friday, caused this. Well, you have the same, the euro currency suffered the same slump in value against the dollar, as did the yen, the Japanese yen, the Australian dollar and the Canadian dollar. And the difference is that the USA has energy security and Europe doesn't, you see. So I don't think it's to do with that. There's a problem with mortgage lenders have started changing all the mortgage products, you know, the mortgages that they offer. They've withdrawn lots of them.
Okay.
Yeah, that's because they offered a lot of fixed rate mortgages, and they don't want to do that anymore because inflation is so high, and this predates the budget, that the Bank of England is going to keep putting up interest rates. So, you know, of course, everybody is going to want to have their mortgage rates fixed for 2 or 3 or 5 years, like they used to be able to. But the mortgage companies, you know, they're like casinos. You know, the house always wins, right? You know, they set it up so the house always wins. Well, they don't want to lose out on that. They're going to pull those products.
Sure.
They pulled a lot of one where you pay a fee. You pay, like, say, £1,000 in advance, and you get a slightly lower interest rate. So you're paying your interest up front. But,
okay.
You know, that's based on a certain interest rate, and if the interest rate is going to go up, then, you know, the bank or the mortgage lender loses out. So I don't think it's to do with that budget. You know, the big thing is that the government is spending, it's going to borrow about $60 billion, they say, to pay for, to keep people's household bills down.
Okay.
In other words, to subsidize people's gas and electricity bills. So that's increasing government borrowing. And then there was a run on government debt bonds, you know.
Very well.
Like government bonds.
Sure. Let's bring in Shabir Rizvi in here to get a little bit clearer, Shabir Rizvi, about, or maybe you can tell us why this proposed tax cuts, which, first of all, depending on what publication you're reading, but it seems to be unanimous that it's going to benefit the rich more than the poor, why it has caused this domino effect in different sectors, not different sectors, in different factors that have pulled the UK economy into doldrums, as it's been reported. Perhaps you can explain it to us in layman's terms, of course.
Hello, good evening, Kaveh. It's really interesting times to be commenting as to what's happening to the UK economy. My day job is as a financial advisor, advising clients how to borrow money, how to invest their income, and so on. And it has been really quite a shocking week. It really comes after Mrs. Truss defended her vision for the economy, which has spooked markets and shocked most economists, mainstream economists. So, you know, everyone is really quite intrigued as to the policies that have been implemented. And then, of course, this week saw, yes, there are factors that other currencies have also fallen against the dollar, but this week the pound touched the lowest value ever against the dollar. You know, dollar which was invested 250 years ago. And the Bank of England are so alarmed that they poured billions into the market. Why they did that? Because a lot of money, pension funds are invested in it, and they didn't want the pension funds to collapse. Interest on government borrowing goes from almost 0% to 5% in weeks. The IMF is also spooked. The Chancellor dare not publish the report of the independent experts. It's expected to be published sometime in October now, and he was sort of pushing it forward for end of November. And what we are told, the mantra we are told, is that don't worry, say both Truss and Kutang, an age of prosperity is just down the road. We've been living for the last 12 years in the age of austerity, where the rich have been getting richer and the poor have been getting poorer. And really, you know, it's really extraordinary. You know, for the last 40 years, the neoliberal economist mantra has been to say that trickle-down economics, meaning that make the rich richer, therefore some money will trickle down to the poor. This is what I like to sort of dub as voodoonomics, not Reaganomics, not Thatcheronomics, not Trussonomics. It's pure voodoonomics. There is no fundamental basis that by reducing 5% tax on the wealthiest would sort of somehow make the poorer better off. It's absolutely sort of outrageous. It has no basis in conventional economic thinking. It's an economy based on ideology. The Tory party, as I said, has made rich richer in the last 12 years, and they want to continue to do so for the next 2 years that they're in power.
Well, James Sweeney, that's pretty much what our guest there, Shabir Rizvi, has said, is what many economists agree, and that is that trickle-down economics doesn't work. Of course, it depends on who you're talking to. At the same time, we know that Liz Truss has said, this is not going to make me a popular prime minister, but I'm going to go with it anyways, and she has actually embarked on this and is not going to shy away from it. If she knows that it's not going to work, based on what it has, economists have said, or other analysts have said, she's very steadfast in going through with it. What do you think the reason for that is, knowing that many have said trickle-down economics doesn't work?
Well, conventional economics, as taught in the West, is voodoo. That's for sure. But it's very strange to see the same people who said that trickle-down economics really does work, laissez-faire economics is great, for decades, and now saying it doesn't, the same people. The Tories have argued, and they can back this up, that cutting corporation tax actually increases tax revenue because you get more investment. Now, whether that's going to keep working, because it has in the past, but whether that's going to keep working in the current crisis, which is not, which is caused by an external factor, then I don't know. You see, you can't tell.
There might be an external factor. We're going to get into that, and I'm going to ask both of you whether that's the case.
I'm going to say, look, in Marxist economics, you need a capitalist to employ people. That's what creates jobs. You need capitalists, bigger capitalists, more capitalists. So yeah, it kind of works, but. What's going on is that, again, all the economists said the free market was sacred, and now we have this immense distortion of the market, of the free market, by putting embargoes and sanctions on Russian oil imports, and now blowing up the pipelines, the oil and gas imports, and now blowing up the gas pipelines. You see, that has, and of course, that distortion has created an economic crisis because the price of gas has gone up like tenfold in 2 years. So, there's all sorts of things going on here. But, what's going to happen? She's going to be unpopular because a lot of the things that were in that budget would be popular with the people who vote Conservative. They're reducing taxes, including on the basic rate of tax for people that most people pay. Right. They increase the threshold where you pay stamp duty, which is a tax on buying a house. Many more people will be exempt from that because the threshold is now $500,000. And all these things, that was all sort of bread and butter stuff. But now what you're going to have, apparently there's a fear that the house price, the house market, the prices of houses will crash. So people who own house, they don't own them, they're paying mortgages, but people with property, the value of their property will fall and they will be unhappy about the thing is that the house market here is ridiculously overheated to the extent everything is overpriced, people can't afford to buy.
Okay.
It needs to come down, and half of the properties on the market you see now, they're being sold at auction, which means that the only people who can buy them are big-time landlords who've got that much money in the bank to pay when the auction is over.
Let's move to that external factor that I'd like to ask Shabir Rizvi here, that maybe a reason, and a very good reason for Liz Truss, to Shabir Rizvi, to have introduced this tax cut plan. When she was running to become the prime minister, she, during one of the sessions that she was presenting herself to the Friends of Israel, obviously displaying how much she supports Israel in so many ways, but said that the trade deal with Israel needs to be revamped. And she was very quick when she came into office to go ahead with that and finalize that, at the same time making the announcement that she's going to have UK's embassy possibly move from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. Now, it's very interesting that that would be at the top of her list, the trade for trade treaty to be revamped. Do you think that she's made promises to Israel, as an example, that you're going to get tax cuts, come and invest in the UK, and let's revamp the treaty that we had before? So she has to follow through with these tax cuts for the corporations, for example?
Well, look, you know, the Israel angle is interesting, but I think it's very clear, if you look at it, wherever Israel is participating in economic activity, they really don't invest that much. They want more money to come into Israel for investment, whether it's technology from the, you know, so the Silicon Valley in the USA, or whether it's Indian investment into armament and biotechnology and other areas. So I don't know what benefit that would derive to the UK. But at a broader level, the mantra that is being sort of fed to the public here in UK, as you know very well, is that it's due to Putin that the oil prices has gone up. It's due to Putin that we have high inflation. Food security is being sort of put on the special operation in Ukraine. So everything that is happening to the British economy, the Tory government does not want to take and be honest, saying that they have inflicted austerity for the last 12 years on the British public. And this is an aspect of that austerity, so that the poorer become poorer, and is being sold to the public that, you know, tax is being reduced and so on. You know, 1% reduction in what is called national insurance tax here on, say, someone average salary earning here, 25, 30, 40,000 pounds. That's only £400 per year, that 1%. While the top 1%, 700,000 people in UK who would benefit by the 5% reduction in income tax, if someone is £100,000, £1 million a year, that's £50,000 extra in their pocket. So again, as I said earlier, the whole concept that if you make rich even richer by way of other instruments, whether it's a reduction in personal taxation, corporation taxation, and other aspects, will make the wider society cheaper. But if I may just continue for 1 minute, that, you know, the policy that's being portrayed by Truss and her team and Mr. Kwasi Kwarteng is to make Britain less regulated. But dare I say that for the last 40 years, probably Britain is the most deregulated country in Europe at this moment. I don't know how far deregulation will go. Does it mean that a serfdom would come back into the UK like it was in Victorian times? Is that kind of a unregulated market that the Tories want to have in the UK? Right. And, you know, ideas are being touted that they want London to be the Singapore on the Thames, unregulated, you know, for the wealthy and the rich, and absolutely regulated for the poor and the disenfranchised.
Sure. Well, I'm not too sure if that's going to work for the UK there, James Tweedy, when you have even the International Monetary Fund coming out. And this was surprising when the IMF comes out and makes a statement saying that what the fiscal measures Britain is adopting is actually going to increase inequality, urging UK authorities to reconsider providing more targeted support instead to affected families and businesses. Now, why would the IMF come out making that statement? First of all, wasn't there inequality in the UK before anyways?
The IMF is responsible for, you know, the continuation of colonial and post-colonial inequalities in the world, so they should know about inequality. It's actually baffling why they're saying that, why the White House is saying that, why the White House is even talking about it like it's their business. You know, I've never heard the US government interfering in Britain's economics or economic affairs before. I think, you know, like I say, it all comes back to inflation and the sanctions on Russia. That's not going to change. And yesterday, the shadow defense minister, Labour Party MP called Healey, said that the government will change. He's very sure of that. I'm not so sure. But and the Labour Party will be in power, but the policy towards Ukraine will not change. And he said that anyone who says stop the war is playing into Vladimir Putin's hands. So he's just as militant against Russia and for this war in the Ukraine as Liz Truss is. And so is the Labour Party, you see. So nothing is going to change. In fact, none of the parties in Parliament are proposing a different policy. So the crisis is going to continue. You know, we have this, you know, both the main parties are talking about sort of moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic in order to try and deal with the problem of gas and therefore electricity prices, oil and therefore electricity prices and every other kind of price going through the roof. The conservative way is going to be to borrow money to give to people to pay their bills, but those people will have to pay that money in the end, in the future, through taxation as that debt is paid off, probably after the next election. The Labour policy is to put a windfall tax, as they call it, on companies like BP, British Petroleum, that produce the actual gas and oil, and are making much bigger profits because of the global market price being very high now. But then they'll pay that money straight back to those companies,
sure,
as a subsidy for people's bills, you see. So those companies will make the same profit twice, and they'll continue to make that profit.
We got 30 seconds left, so I'm going to jump in. I'm sorry, to and ask Shabir Rizvi the question. Shabir Rizvi, I was trying to look at the ways, different ways that the UK is spending money. £500 billion, I believe, is what's going to go for the energy issue. You were looking at another $500 million for the Ukraine war. These are just recent acts. And there was another $500 million. I don't know why this 500 is a figure that is repeated, where the UK has promised in another area, which I'm not coming up with that figure right now. But these are big chunks of money. Where is this money coming from that Liz Truss believes that it can just invest in different areas or to allocate in different areas when the economy is doing as bad as it is right now? 30 seconds only.
Well, famously, Theresa May said that we don't have money tree. But the reality is that the government sort of plants new money tree as and when required for their purpose. But when it's sort of, you know, for the National Health Service, for the improvement of the education sector, where students don't have to pay fees for their university degrees.
Thank you.
There's no money available.
I thank you for that, Shabir Rizvi. I do apologize for jumping in. Political and economic analyst there from London. Thank you, Shabir. Also, journalist and commentator James Sweetie from Plymouth, UK. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavitawe and the team, it's goodbye.